Welcome to the Stories of School Leadership podcast, inspirational leaders, shared experiences, creating connections. I'm Emma Lurie and thank you for joining me as I share the journey, stories and inspiration of amazing educational leaders from all around the world. In this episode, I get to speak to the incredible Vivian Porritt, who is an OBE, a leader in education and global strategic lead of the Women Ed community. She talks to us about her experience in education and the things that have driven her to advocate for the voices of women and to support leaders all across the world in making brave decisions and brave choices. So I can't wait to share this with you. Let's get into it. Hi, Vivian. It's so amazing to have you with us. I'm so grateful that you have given up some time in your, what I imagine is a very busy schedule. I'm really, really grateful. And I'm so looking forward to hearing more about your own journey and the things that inspire you and some of the projects that you are working on at the moment that support others. So if you wouldn't mind just sharing with listeners who you are and where you are at the moment, where you're from, that would be fab.
I'm Vivian Porritt. I'm from the northeast of England. A working class girl, very definitely. I now live at the opposite end of the country in Surrey and still feel a little bit out of an outsider in a more middle class area, you might say. And I've been in education all of my life as a teacher and a leader, and now as one of the trustees and global strategic leaders of Women Ed, a charity that empowers and elevates women educators and leaders.
And a wonderful one it is, certainly. We'll get into sort of the current things that you're working on and things that inspire you a little bit later, but I'm really nosy, but I'm really fascinated in hearing about people's own educational experience, because from people I've spoken to, that often has links into some of the journeys that have taken, yes, some of the steps that they've taken. So will you share with us a bit about your own experience of kind of school and education and what that was like for you?
Well, I loved learning at school, really loved it. Home life was quite challenging and difficult. So it was lovely to be at school at times and just be immersed in what it feels like to learn. I went to the schools in the northeast, then were really divided between along religious lines. And my mum was a Catholic, not really practicing, but therefore we had to go to a Catholic primary and a Catholic secondary. But there was the 11 plus then. And if you passed the 11 plus and you were Catholic and a girl, you had to travel about 15 miles to the secondary school. But I loved the school and I had some lovely teachers. One of my abiding memories, though, is that I don't know whether the teachers knew I had a difficult, challenging home life. So the fact that I got my homework in, that I turned up, sometimes looking a bit rough for wear because I was getting me and my sister out of the house on our own. Nobody mentioned that at that time. Nowadays, teachers would be all over that kind of thing. And education is better for that now than it was then. But that's what it was like. And then education went comprehensive. And on one site, they moved the girls' grammar school, the boys' grammar school, the girls' secondary modern, the boys' secondary modern, all on put, just shoved them on one site. But I was in the sixth form then, so that was okay. My sister had it more rough in that way. So did well at A-levels and then went to Leeds University to do English.
Amazing. You're right. I resonated a lot with how often in the working in schools or leadership, now we think so much around those characteristics for children and the challenges that are facing in at home and other experiences in terms of in the community. And you're right, that's I think it's quite recent, actually, if we look back in how much we recognize the different things that impact on our children and then what we do it about it as a result. And that certainly comes up in when we talk to other people about the challenges that they're facing, because sometimes that recognition of what we do as teachers and educators, it's so much more than the academic. And sometimes I think that doesn't always translate. People don't always understand the magnitude of what we're trying to do for our young people. So it's really powerful to share,
Yes, I
you know, the
would
different
agree with that.
experiences.
And that was one of the reasons I went into teaching, because I didn't want another child to sometimes feel as I did, that I was working hard, I was doing everything I possibly could within some very challenging experiences. And I think I just sometimes wanted somebody to recognize that and talk to me about it. So that's why I went into education, to make sure another child didn't feel as I did.
Oh, what a powerful vision and what reason behind doing it. And so when you were studying English, was it always the plan that you would teach and
Oh,
go
I was
from
going to always going to teach from when I was little.
there? Oh, really?
In my TEDx talk, I've talked about making my sister play schools all the time. I was always going to be a teacher. I don't know why, beyond the reason I've said, but that's what I was always going to do.
That is so fascinating. And from my parental perspective, I experience that now with my own children. But I remember being an early years teacher and some really opportunities to reflect on my own practice when the children would role play being me as a teacher. And it's so fascinating. Parents would come in and say, "Well, they've been pretending to be you." And I'm thinking, "Oh, is that good? Is that bad?" And lots of children do that, don't they? And fascinating to think that was your younger self kind of playing out maybe, yeah, the role you would take. So, what was your early teaching career like? Where did you start? Where did you?
Well, I started at the other end of the country because I was in a relationship then with the person I eventually married, my ex-husband. And I could teach anywhere, obviously, in the country, whereas he was absolutely certain he would get sent to a job in the southeast. So I started applying for schools in the southeast, and I got offered the job for the first one I was interviewed for. And it was a girls' grammar school. I shouldn't have taken the job, looking back, because it wasn't really aligned with my values of a comprehensive education. But I thought I had to get a job quickly because he was going to move down there. As it happened, they sent him to Manchester.
Oh dear.
However, I learned a lot at that school because the girls were brilliant, so clever, so wanting to learn and to do it quickly. My favourite anecdote of it is from a year seven girl, when I'd spent a whole lesson bigging up the book we were going to read for the next few weeks, and getting them to think about, the imagery, the title, what kind of a book, all of that. And this girl came back to the lesson the next day and said, "That was great, miss. What else are we going to read?" And I was still a very new teacher, and I thought, "What am I going to do for the next 5 weeks when somebody's already read the book and maybe more will?" It never occurred to me they would do that. But it taught me a lesson, because it was, don't underestimate what they want to do and can do. So she helped me with the next 5 weeks by suggesting things that she thought the others might want to engage in, because she knew everything that was happening. And that taught me a lesson about, don't underestimate what children want to do and can do.
Yeah.
And I loved the girls at that school. They had such an appetite for whatever you could give them. Then I didn't think that was going to be a brilliant career move for the rest of my work. So I tried to move on, and it was fascinating because no school could believe that I could teach, because it was an easy girls' grammar school. And I went for interviews, and all they wanted to talk to me about was behavior all the time, because they said I obviously didn't really know what behavior was like.
No, you hadn't
And
experienced
then,
maybe the
okay.
challenges they were thinking about.
And the head called me down one day. She said, I've been asked for a reference for you, and they asked if you could deal with behavior. And I said, absolutely, you could, because you were from the north.
You're tough.
I did move, and I moved to the opposite extreme, which was a girls' secondary modern school in Southeast London, and I learnt about behaviour there.
It's amazing, isn't it, the different spectrums of elements of learning. And sometimes you don't even know that's what you're looking for, but you get thrown into it and think, okay, yeah, this is the next bit that you hadn't necessarily
But
experienced.
I learned the same lesson because it was a secondary modern school, because the 11 plus was still in that borough. And the girls that were there felt that they had failed, and they were going to continue to fail. So I just used everything I'd learned about don't underestimate them, tell them they're brilliant, tell them what they can do, and they just blossomed then. So once I got the behaviour cracked, it was a wonderful time in which I could just help girls at that point to blossom. And eventually I ended up in a comprehensive in Sussex. So I learnt to crack behaviour with boys as well then.
And I'm seeing a trend here in what you now do with women ed in terms of elevating and amplifying the voices of, I guess, whether it's young people or people, women or other. That's, I'm hearing that's something that's so important to you, but it is such an important thing as well, isn't it? And I guess that being able to do that helped you with the behavior, because by listening and advocating for young people, they know that we believe in them, that they belong and have a space. And actually, that makes a huge difference if they're sat in a space where they think this person cares about me and knows about me, exactly what you were talking about from your own experience. So, yeah, really fascinating. And how did you get into leadership then? What was that leap like?
The comprehensive in Sussex, I became an assistant head teacher there. So I'd moved up the usual ranks, second in a department, head of department. Then I became an assistant head teacher, and I became deputy head at that same school. And then I moved into Surrey and became a head teacher there.
And how was that? What was that role like?
It was a fabulous school. Interestingly, it was a school that was quite insular. In one of the structural moves, it had become a foundation school, which meant it wasn't part of the local authority. But I didn't agree with that, so I made sure we got involved in the local authority and our partner schools as well. And enabled the school to show what it could do, really. The first bid I put in there was to be a training school, which was the forerunners of teaching schools. And a training school only focused on initial teacher training. So we became a beacon school for teacher trainees, which was great because it was the first really bad recruitment crisis. So we learned very quickly we had to grow our own, because there wasn't anybody else to employ at the time. And so we did some fabulous things, became a specialist arts, performing arts school as well, because I did drama at university also. So I was then had been teaching English and drama. And it was a fabulous school, loved working there.
Amazing. And you, I guess, you've talked a bit about your inspiration in terms of your experience inspiring you and learning from the children, but were there maybe people or leaders in your in that part of your career or externally that inspired you to want to do more and to step into that leadership role or experience, I suppose?
I think my motivation to become a leader was usually for two reasons. One was I can see back looking over my career, I needed to keep doing something different. Every couple of years, I'd change roles, even if I stayed in the same school. And then, so I needed to keep changing for me. And also, I sometimes looked at existing leaders and thought, well, there's another way of doing this. There is a better way of doing this. And so, in the end, I would think, well, I can't keep saying that. I have to show that, really.
And if we took the lid off some of those characteristics or behaviors that you learned what not to do, maybe, or felt were different, what are the key things that were, I guess, frustrating you, or you were feeling like you wanted it to be different?
The not to do's were to be apart from your colleagues, to feel as if you were elevated ab above them, and that they couldn't contribute and they couldn't support and help everybody in the organization in that way, rather than just a small group of people who seemed to run the organization, not always well. When I went to the school where I was an assistant head and a deputy head, I worked with a brilliant head teacher, and he helped me to exemplify those kinds of characteristics, because he always took it for granted you could do whatever you wanted to do. And he always, always thought about the impact on the person who was doing the work. I can remember one day I'd gone into school on a Sunday because I was visiting friends for lunch. So I popped into school on the way back to finish something I wanted to do, which was a teaching and learning document for the sixth forms. I was head of sixth form as part of the assistant head teacher role. And he came in later on. He said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I'm just finishing this. I was there and I'm just finishing this." He said, "What is it?" So I told him. He said, "I didn't know you were doing that." Said, "I've been doing it for months." I just keep playing with it and twiddling with it. "Give it to me," he said. Said, "It's not finished. Give it to me." And then we had a conversation about the difference between it being good enough and perfect.
That sounds like a very valid conversation for many of us to have.
Yeah. And he said, 80% is enough. And like my face was aghast. "No, it's not. You can't be, there's mistakes in it if it's 80%." He said, "But you've been doing it for months." And he really helped me get a grip on thinking about moving away from the perfectionism that so many women leaders experience or feel. But that's the gendered stereotypes. We're made to feel like that. It's not because it's part of our own nature. It's what we've learnt from what people tell us. So I then wanted to help other leaders to just not suffer as I had suffered under perfectionism.
Yeah, and that's such an important message, and your work now with Women Ed really encapsulates that focus on illuminating and recognizing that difference and how things are for women in education and as we step into leadership. So that's a perfect opportunity for to talk about that next step. I don't know if there was a gap between your kind of headship and Women Ed itself or some of the other work that you've been doing, but I'd really love to hear more about how Women Ed began and what that looked like.
Well, after headship, I moved out of schools and I went to work for a university, so the Institute of Education in London, where I became a senior leader there. And my role was school partnerships, director of school partnerships in the end. So I was still working with schools around across London. But while towards the end of my time there, I became ill with breast cancer, and cognitively couldn't do very much for quite a while. I couldn't watch the television, I couldn't read, I couldn't do those kinds of things. But I'd joined Twitter, so I could manage 144 characters as it was then. My brain could cope with
Could
that.
do that much.
And I met a lot of amazing women online, and I seemed to gravitate that way, really. And out of the connections we made, and out of some of the frustrations we all were experiencing about what it was like to be a woman leader, because I was a woman leader in a university then, which was a lot worse than a woman leader in a school, a lot worse, as it's highly misogynistic and highly sexist in some university cultures. So we were very frustrated, and there was new data came out about the lack of women leaders in leadership, and then the gender pay gap came out. So we all got a bit riled up. And Kezia, who's still one of the central team alongside me, said, "Shall we have a little tea party about all of this?" And that's a very favourite quote that I like to share. And in the end, we put Women Ed together, seven of us, all online, because we didn't meet for the first time, all of us, till the night before our first conference at dinner.
And how many years or months
That was
later
in
was that?
2015.
Wow.
And it didn't occur to us we would do anything other than some of the work we were doing in England. But then some people in England moved to other countries, and they took Women Ed with them. And we just then started to blossom and grow. So from very small beginnings and small intentions, we only wanted to give women a voice on Twitter, because a lot of the big hitters on Twitter then that were male were silencing women in the conversations, not letting them join in. And we just wanted to give women a voice on Twitter, which is why there's a mic in our logo. But it's grown a little bit since then.
An understatement, isn't it? From a tea party to, and so tell us a bit more about what it is now. I'm guessing lots of people will be aware of and know Women Ed Movement, but for those that don't or are just are kind of only know a little snippet of it, what is it like now and what sort of work?
Well, we're structured around our networks still. So, networks in England, the UK, Europe, Asia, Canada, Australia. And our network leaders are all volunteers, as the central team is. And we all do what we do on top of our day job, because we're passionate about wanting to support women. There's 34 networks globally. And at the moment, we're talking to some women in Japan who are really keen. So I really hope that's our next one, which would be fabulous. And the networks put events on, and we've got in-person events coming back, which is terrific now, because they, like the Unconference in London, they've got a very powerful energy, haven't they? When
Absolutely.
all of the women there are there together to support and uplift each other. We have people contribute to our books. So we have two books out, 10% Braver and Being 10% Braver. And I have literally just sent the final manuscript to the publishers for our third book, which is called, drum roll please, Disruptive Women: A Women Ed Guide to Equitable Action in Education.
So needed, so needed. I think absolutely the first event that I'd ever attended was the Unconference, and the mixture of the way that it felt in terms of being very equal to everybody, that was just so palpable, is that the right word? Because I think there is that sense of hierarchy, even if you don't want it to be, whether you are leading in education or in other sectors, I'm sure. But when you go to an event or an organization or you engage in a with, you know, a movement, to feel that everybody's voice is as valid as each other's is so important. And I know that same feeling in terms of speaking to you or speaking to the other leaders, everybody's there to support one another. And that's a, not an easy thing to make happen. So it's certainly a very special movement, a special organization.
Oh, and that's why we call the larger events an unconference, because we didn't want any of that hierarchical thinking. We didn't want experts coming to talk to us and then disappearing. People that speak at those events are there all day as delegates as well. We all are there to learn and help from each other. So it's lovely to hear that you experienced that as well. And really, everything anybody wants to know about Women Ed is on our website. You can, if you're not on social media, you can see what the networks are doing in the website. You can buy the books, you can donate to help Women Ed, which we would be very grateful for, as we don't charge for anything except those bigger events, because we pay people for, we've got to give people lunch and things like that. And we'd be very grateful as a charity, which we are now, for any help anybody could give us. There's a page on the website for that. There's opportunities to develop and learn yourself. We have a fabulous funded apprenticeship program in England for women to become professional coaches. And that's an amazing opportunity for the Women Ed cohorts there. And women are really elevated by coaching and want to coach others. So it's great. There's a qualification for them there for life in that way. Blogs. We have hundreds of blogs. We've just published three blogs just this week. And one is lovely because it's what Women Ed is doing for women. And it's an absolutely fabulous blog. So go on the website and read that. The website is womened.com. So it's really easy to remember. And all our campaign knowledge is there. We have four campaigns: increase the representation of women leaders, increase the representation of more diverse women leaders, advocate for flexible working, and reduce the absolutely ridiculous, horrific gender pay gap in education. And we've got articles, podcasts, books, videos, all there to help people disrupt the status quo, the inequitable status quo for women in education. And we really want every woman to be 10% braver and do something that will change the status quo for themselves and for other women in their organization.
Yeah, it is amazing. And you, I guess, in the work that you've been doing since it started and before, I'm sure you must hear so many stories around those four areas and those big pillars that women are facing those challenges in. At the moment, what are the biggest challenges and kind of little examples of those challenges that women are facing? Because I think for many women, certainly that I have worked with, it's not talked about enough. They don't feel that it's you talked about, you know, it's not something we're necessarily aware of. We think that it's just us, or it's just the way that we're, you know, interpreting something, or it's in our personality. So what are the big things that you're hearing a lot at the moment?
We still hear some horror stories, significant horror stories about the recruitment processes. And of course, we're moving into prime recruitment phase, stage. Women still asked illegal questions like, are you going to have children? Still being asked that and not knowing
Shocking.
how to reply. Because they say, well, I might not get the job if I reply. I said, well, do you want the job if they're
Yeah.
going to ask you a question like that? We have to take some power ourselves and don't feel that you have to have the first job that gets offered to you, like I did. You don't really don't have to, especially in a recruitment crisis, because there's lots of jobs. So the recruitment process is a concern. The gender pay gap is a significant concern because the size of the gap is growing, which is very frustrating for us, given how much we campaign against it. But our job is really to make people aware of it and what's happening and what the size of it is and what you can do to tackle it. And that's all on our website and in our videos as well. Flexible working, there's a lot of work going on with that, both from the Department for Education and ourselves and Flex Teach Talent and the MTPT project. There's a lot of work going on with it. And we need schools to understand that it's the way forward in a recruitment crisis, especially, but also because we need to retain women in the profession. They're 75% of the profession. So we can't keep doing things that drive them away.
No, and I've certainly I'm shocked by, and usually it's around the flex working, the stories that people will say around, yes, how they are treated when they request flexible working, or even in some organizations at that higher level, just the conversations that are happening around whether they believe job shares are good or bad, and just that recognition of how, by supporting women to work in a way that works for them, you will get the best out of them. And oh my gosh, my children have had teachers who work flexibly, and I've worked with many, many, and they are incredible. You get job shares that fit together. There's lots of co-headships now
Absolutely.
starting, aren't they? But I mean, how blooming amazing to be able to have two wonderful women in a job. One can do a great job as well, but there's such value to it, and it's so frustrating to hear voices, and some of those are female voices. In leadership levels at sort of CEO level and other, saying that that's not something that's beneficial. It feels so behind the curve to
So
our corporate
archaic.
counterparts. Yeah, absolutely.
So archaic. And we have a very significant section on flexible working in our new book. So there's some amazing ways to disrupt it and solve those problems.
Yeah, a really important aspect. So it's been amazing speaking to you, and I know you have so many other things that you have done. Before we finish, I would love to know what else you want to do. What else is your next things that you want to achieve, either with Women Ed or other, that you think kind of in your vision for the next, I don't know, 5 years?
Well, outside of Women Ed, I work as a leadership consultant myself, and I really want to support leaders to move away from this fear or compliance culture that is there in schools. Because there isn't much you can do in school that you'd get sacked for, really, beyond the usual things that anybody would be sacked for. So I'm not sure why some leaders are too cautious. I want to see a culture shift in schools in particular to be able to harness the power and the intelligence of the community in the school and the community they work with. And look again at how education can work, because I think we're in a fear factor at the moment. And it's not just Ofsted, which obviously has to change. There's a lots of other accountability measures that make people afraid to do what they think might be best for children and for their colleagues. So I want more of a discussion about the culture in schools. When I became a head teacher, and did one of the very early NPQH programs, culture was the key word. And I don't see it mentioned very often in the development opportunities for leaders anymore. And some of the cultures in some trusts, I think, are unhelpful in that way. And I just want people to feel that they've got talent and expertise and experience, and that they are enabled to use it for themselves, their colleagues, and the students. That's what I would like as a leadership guru or a leadership fanatic, whatever you would call it. And for Women Ed, we want to be able to survive as a charity. So donate, please. Help us with that. Because it costs a heck of a lot of money to run the website.
Absolutely. And it's
But we
elevated
want,
with crisis, isn't it?
sorry, I
No,
missed
go
that.
on.
And we want to reach more and more women, definitely, because we are still based on social media, and therefore there's a lot of women that we can help and support who don't know about us yet. So we hope everybody listening will advocate for that and put women in touch with Women Ed.
Absolutely. I think I have spoken to so many leaders and other professionals working in education who feel that making decisions that what that we might think are quite simple and straightforward, and why would you not do those things? They are talking about some of those decisions as being brave and having to be brave to make some of those decisions, and it's because they are maybe going against or slightly changing things. They're feeling like they're very, pigeonholed, and it's got to be done in a certain way. And you're right, that's about the accountability. That's because of the biases that are put onto people. But it feels like it should be more straightforward, and people should be able to make those decisions, and that it just shouldn't feel like we're needing to be so brave. But they're definitely, I hope, feels that the tides are starting. There's rumbling happening. There's big organisations, aren't there, in Women Ed, but other ones looking at questioning that accountability model and thinking about leadership. So I'm hoping that we're getting some momentum to move forward and make things different, because it's an incredible sector to be in, but certainly the challenges sometimes outweigh that feeling, and that's something that we need to change.
Well, your podcast will help a lot. So thank you for doing it.
Hopefully. Amazing. Thank you so much for your time, Vivian. Really, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. We will be posting about Women Ed, and we cannot wait to read the third book, because it sounds like it's exactly what we all need right now, and for men to read those books as well. So men listening, do not think that because it is Women Ed, you cannot advocate and listen to it, because we need you to elevate the voices of women as well. And we need you to be aware of what we're talking about and what's happening, and read those books, because they're not just for women, they are for men to learn more about it as well, aren't they?
And we have male authors in the books as well. Not this one, but in the first two, we do.
Yeah, amazing. Vivian, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Emma. A pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to the Stories of School Leadership podcast. We'd love to know your thoughts on this episode. Get in touch and tell us what you think, and share this episode with colleagues so we can spread the word. If you'd like some support with leadership coaching, supervision or consultancy, you can get in touch with me via the Stories of School Leadership Instagram account, or I'm Emma Lurie on LinkedIn, or you can send me an email. It's info@emmalurie.co.uk. I hope you have a great day, whatever you're up to next, and I can't wait to share the next episode with you. Goodbye.